So in a lot of ways, this is going to be more of an exercise in practical cosmology than the last couple of talks, but I guess it's consistent with what following Chazal. This is, for the most part, based on these two publications here, although there are rapidly other publications coming out along the same line. So just as what I'm basically going to do is I'm going to start by describing this particular scenario of preheating, talk about how it can be achieved through a very popular classical mechanism known as parametric resonance, discuss how that can generate substantial gravitational radiation in the early universe, and then talk about the predictions where we could possibly see this radiation today, with emphasis on the particular numerical simulations that we're using to generate these predictions. So just as a quick review, although it seems like Robert's name has been up on this board a lot during this session, but this was an idea that was first, the idea of parametric resonance as a method of efficient reheating was first discovered by Brandenburger and Troschen in 1990. Later on, it was predicted, about a decade later, I guess, that such a process would produce gravitational radiation, and an order of magnitude estimate was made in 1997, about another decade passed. And then at some point in 2005, we decided that we had the technology to apply this problem in a precision cosmology sort of way and started simulations at that point. And since then, it's really taken off. There are three other groups, one in Madrid led by Juan Garcia Bolido. There's a group based at CETA, which is apparently close to here. And then a new group at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, that's backwards, who are also interested in this particular question of predicting these signals. So I won't talk too much about inflation under the prior that most people here are familiar with it. It's a paradigm without a mechanism, but it seems to solve a lot of the issues that cosmologists were having 28 years ago. And it also goes on to predict to first-order scale invariant power spectrum of density fluctuations. The problem is that in traditional scalar field-motivated cosmology, we don't have a way to get the energy that's in the inflaton efficiently transferred into other fields in the universe. I'm going to achieve this by taking a toy model where the inflaton is coupled to a second bosonic field via a standard g squared, phi squared, chi squared coupling. Okay. In this case, it's very easy to write down the equations of motion for chi. I'm sure we've all done it. And I've written down the mode equations because that's the most interesting for cosmological perturbations, where I've used this standard Fourier convention. If I additionally assume our favorite toy model of inflation, just a massive scalar field, and for the moment turn off the expansion of the universe for analytic purposes, I know that at the end of inflation, the phi field is going to coherently oscillate about its minimum sinusoidally with some amplitude that I'm calling capital phi. If I plug this into the equation of motion for the chi modes that I have on the previous slide, I have this sort of standard differential equation. And for those of you who I suppose have taught or maybe taken math methods for physics recently, you might recognize this as a Mathieu equation under a very specific coordinate transformation. Now, the great thing about Mathieu equations is that their solutions are characterized by two parameters, A and Q. And if you know what A and Q is, then you know that the solution is either a stable solution, that is, it's an oscillatory one, or it's an unstable solution, and it's exponentially excited. This is a chart of the Mathieu space, where the darker regions correspond to the solutions that are exponential. What we know is that our model fixes this parameter Q, just given the amplitude of the oscillating phi field and then the parameters in the model. And the second parameter, A sub k, is set by a combination of parameters in the model here, plus the value of the momentum k squared. So this restricts the entire Mathieu parameter space to just a line that looks something like this. So once I have the parameters of the model, and I'm looking at a particular k-mode, I can look along this red line to see whether or not that k-mode has an exponentially excited solution. So what you should take away from this chart, if nothing else, is that there are, for general cosmological models, most of this parameter space along this line corresponds to stable solutions. That is, solutions that you would not expect to be excited. But there should be bands along this line that have exponential excitement. Okay. So what that implies, and if I had more time, I'd have a pretty movie. But what that implies is that we have particular values of the momentum for which this field is excited, and many values of the momentum for which this field is not excited. And what that means is that we end up at the end of the parametric resonance stage with a universe that's extremely out of equilibrium. There's a large amount of gradient energy, and a large amount of gradient energy then will hopefully lead to the production of gravitational waves, and I'll talk about that in the next slide. Another take-home message is that although, for the most part, I'll be talking about our standard models of inflation, m squared, phi squared, and lambda phi to the fourth, but any model of inflation whose end is coherent oscillation about some minimum should exhibit this property, because any minimum can be modeled as a sum of these other minima, and therefore we can expect to see at least an effective behavior like this in any model where inflation ends via oscillations. Okay, so so now to look at gravitational radiation, I assume a metric perturbation of a pure tensor form that satisfies the transverse traceless conditions. If I plug that back into Einstein's equations, I come up with the familiar expression for the equations of motion of the metric perturbations. And on the right-hand side, I have a source term that is actually that is a combination of the different components of the stress energy tensor. Moreover, to assure that the source for these metric perturbations is truly a tensor source, I have to project this source onto the transverse traceless space via this standard projection operator. And this is something I mentioned because there's in this blooming field of predicting gravitational radiation from cosmological models, this is a point that, that comes into discussion a lot. And my view is that I like to always project out the transverse traceless part of the metric at the source level of the simulation for reasons that if I do it at that point, so here are the transverse and traceless components of the source, I end up with metric perturbations on the bottom that are both transverse and traceless. And I like to show this because it's about 6 months worth of work. But so in practice, what do? We have a three torus, and we put regular scalar fields on them, classical scalar fields. And we allow the fields to evolve via the complete equation of motion. There's a well-known program called Lattice Easy that calculates that will evolve for us the scalar fields on the lattice, as well as evolving the scale factor A. On top of that, we add to it a package that we wrote that will evolve the metric perturbations alongside the scalar field. So what it does is it calculates this source term, converts it, puts it into momentum space, projects to the transverse traceless space, and then sources the metric perturbations alongside the evolving universe. Once we have the HIJs at any time, then we can translate that into an energy density via the standard relation, and transfer that to the current day. So, where do we start? Being that in 1997, Klebnikov and Tachev started with the lambda phi 4 model, we choose to follow their footsteps, basically because it's a great comparison to all of the previous work that's been done in this sector. Having said that, here's the work that's being done in this sector. When we started in 2005, we were actually using a slightly different model that I've left off today. But our current model is summarized in this first column here, and you can see how it compares to the other methods. we're lucky to have two groups, the one based at CETA and the one in Milwaukee, that are using a Green's functions method to evolve to predict the values of Hij at a later time. Whereas we and the group in Madrid are both using are both evolving explicitly the metric components. The major difference between our group and the Madrid group is that we evolve the metric components in momentum space, and the Madrid group has chosen to evolve their metric components in position space. They also project, as I was saying before, they project out the transverse traceless part at the end of the simulation, and we do it at the source level. We actually had trouble with both of these things, but there's a big difference between our specific evolution mechanism and theirs. What's nice is that there's also some difference between these two groups in that the CETA group uses an approximate Green's method, and the Milwaukee group uses an exact Green's method, but don't explicitly evolve the scale factor. They assume a functional form of the evolution of the scale factor, I should say. So after a couple years of work, we have curves that look pretty good. The red curve in this graph is ours compared to the blue curve, which is some of the current data from the CETA group. And this curve, the Yale group is in black, and the Milwaukee group is the dotted line. So we are converging on an answer. 5 years ago, this 10 to the minus 11 was a theoretical prediction made by the Klebnikov and Tachev paper. And now we have not only an order of magnitude, but we are converging on a general shape of this spectrum. So the only problem that one should notice is that the peak of this gravitational radiation is somewhere around, I don't know, 2 × 10⁸ hertz. And if you were a gravitational wave experimentalist, which I don't think there are any in the audience, you would be concerned by this, because this is not in the plans. I might have a graph of this later. This is not in the plans of gravitational wave observatories today, at least those proposals which are reasonable. So let's try to understand that. So if I take the transfer function that I had written a few slides ago, and I look at what goes into the transfer function, I can assume that the peak gravitational radiation that's produced during the preheating era, or epoch, will be some normal fraction of the total total Hubble scale. If I plug that assumption into our transfer function, I see that the peak frequency today is proportional to the fourth root of the inflationary potential. That is, that the peak frequency today is proportional to the energy scale at which inflation occurred. So keep that in mind over the next few slides. What we then decided to look at was the m squared phi squared model, where if I believe that the inflation occurred using the simplest massive scalar field, then we have a constraint due to the CMB on what that mass parameter is. And we see, likewise with gut scale lambda phi 4 inflation, that we have a peak frequency somewhere around 10 to the 9th hertz. But I noticed that if I change the mass parameter from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 7 and explicitly calculate the gravitational wave spectrum, I see that spectrum is moved to the left. And it's moved to the left in exactly the proportion that I predicted on two slides ago. That is, that as I lower the energy scale of inflation, I expect to see the peak frequency modified by the same scale. Oh, so where we are now is over here, and as you can see, that there are no projected observatories that will hit this scale anytime in the near future. Luckily, there's one that's fairly close to the right that's already built. So the question is, if I lower the energy scale enough, is this method sufficiently robust to move the preheating signal that we have at 10 to the 9th hertz down to something that's, say, at 10 to the 2 hertz? I can't do it with simple m squared phi squared inflation, but I can do it with a hybrid model. So if I take the normal hybrid potential, allow sigma to acquire some expectation value, then the potential for phi is effectively an m squared phi squared potential. But this parameter inside, the math parameter for the m squared phi squared potential, is not constrained by the CMB. So it's dynamically identical to cosmological to chaotic inflation, but it does not have the same constraints on the mass parameter that chaotic inflation has. So what I can do is I can start over here at gut scale inflation and work my way down. And as you can see, the simulations get more and more difficult because I'm explicitly calculating a universe that is consistently expanding. Or expanding self-consistently, I should say. But I'm able to lower the energy scale sufficiently enough that it's approaching the observational band produced by, or the observational band that exists at LIGO. So the other interesting characteristic is, of course, that as I move the signal to the left, that is, as I lower the energy scale of inflation, I'm bringing it towards observational frequencies, but I'm not changing the amplitude of this radiation. So here's another cartoon. The highest scale that I showed on that previous graph is in blue. The lowest scale is in purple. If I had the computer a year ago to do one order of magnitude lower, I might have this purple one intersecting the advanced LIGO band. So the follow-up question is, well, we heard about cosmological gravitational radiation our whole lives, but this particular source that I'm talking about is characteristically different from the primordial gravitational wave spectrum, but in a heartening complementary way, that the preheating signal has an amplitude that seems to be fixed somewhere around 10 to the minus 11 omega GW H squared, sometimes around 10 to the minus 11, where the frequency can be lowered by lowering the inflationary energy scale, whereas the primordial signal, the amplitude of that signal is lowered due to the inflationary energy scale. So if we have gut scale inflation, maybe we have a hope of measuring the primordial signal. But if we don't discover a primordial signal, well, then chances are that this preheating signal will be moved down towards observational bounds. So in conclusion, we like to think that the direct detection of gravitational waves is inevitable, that at least on the books, there are some people looking for them. This particular signal provides us a frequency-dependent probe of the energy scale of inflation. It would act as a complementary model selector to the primordial signal. And of course, it would be a new window on inflation that's particularly useful to low-scale models of inflation. Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
So what did you assume about the reheating process, especially when you consider the M squared, phi squared, and hybrid inflation model?
I'm sorry, can you repeat it? I didn't understand.
What is your assumption on the reheating process? You know, when you perform a numerical simulation, you have to, take account of the decay process of the inflator itself.
So this particular reheating process is a classical one. So what's important to achieve parametric resonance in reheating is you have to have the inflaton, the inflation ending by the inflaton or whatever fields oscillating about some minimum. And if the coupling to another field is given by this g squared, phi squared, chi squared potential, then you have a classical excitation of modes of the chi field. So those are the two assumptions, that the inflation ends via oscillation and that you have that particular g squared, phi squared, chi squared term in the potential.